In a way, this is an obvious observation. Anyone who has ever been to the movies knows that the size of the crowd in the theater has a big effect on how good the movie seems. Comedies are never funnier, and thrillers never more thrilling than in a packed movie house. Psychologists tell us much the same thing, that when people are asked to consider evidence or make decisions in a group, they come to very different conclusions than when they're asked the same questions by themselves. Once we're part of a group, we're all susceptible to peer pressure and social norms and any number of other kinds of influence that can play a critical role in sweeping people up in the beginnings of an epidemic. Have you ever wondered, for example, how religious movements get started? Usually we think of them as the product of highly charismatic evangelists, people like the Apostle Paul or Billy Graham or Brigham Young. But the spread of any new and contagious ideology also has a lot to do with the skillful use of group power. In the late 18th and early 19th century, for example, the Methodist movement became epidemic in England and North America, tipping from 20,000 to 90,000 followers in the U.S. in the space of 5 or 6 years in the 1780s. But Methodism's founder, John Wesley, was by no means the most charismatic preacher of his era. Nor was Wesley a great theologian, in the tradition of, say, John Calvin or Martin Luther. His genius was organizational. Wesley would travel around England and North America, delivering open-air sermons to thousands of people. But he didn't just preach. He also stayed long enough in each town to form the most enthusiastic of his converts into religious societies, which in turn he subdivided into smaller classes of a dozen or so people. Each convert was required to attend weekly meetings, to adhere to a strict code of conduct. If they failed to live up to the Methodist standards, they were expelled from the group. This was a group, in other words, that meant something. Over the course of his life, Wesley traveled ceaselessly among these groups, covering as much as 4,000 miles a year by horseback, reinforcing the tenets of Methodist belief. He was a classic connector. He was a super Paul Revere. The difference is, though, that he wasn't one person with ties to many people. He was one person with ties to many groups, which is a small but critical distinction. Wesley realized that if he wanted to bring about a fundamental change in someone's belief and behavior, a change that would persist and serve as an example to others, you needed to create a community around the converts, where those new beliefs could be practiced and expressed and nurtured. This is why Yahya's sisterhood tipped as well. The first bestseller list on which Yahya appeared was the Northern California Independent Booksellers List. Northern California, as well said, was where 600 and 700 people first began showing up at her readings. It was where the Yahya epidemic began. Why? According to Reverend, because the San Francisco area is home to one of the country's strongest book group cultures. And from the beginning, Yahya was what publishers refer to as a book group book. The groups of seven women who Wells noticed coming to her readings were invariably all members of the same reading group. The book group movement of the past decade is, to some extent, a phenomenon of adult women. And Yahya's Sisterhood was a book about the lifelong friendship of a group of adult women. It was the kind of book that people wanted to talk about. And because it was talked about in groups, it became that much stickier. It's easier to remember and appreciate something, after all, if you discuss it for 2 hours with your best friends. It becomes a social experience, an object of conversation, which is why it's not hard to understand how Yahya sparked a word-of-mouth epidemic. Wells says that at the end of her readings, during the question-and-answer session, women in the audience would tell her, "We've been in a book group for 2 years, and then we read your book and something else happened. It started to drop down to a level of sharing that was more like friendship. They told me that they had started going to the beach together or having parties at each other's houses." Women began forming Yahya sisterhood groups of their own in imitation of the group described in the book and bringing Wells pictures of their group for her to sign. Wesley's Methodism spread like wildfire through England and America because Wesley was shuttling back and forth among hundreds and hundreds of groups, and each group was then taking his message and making it even stickier. The word about Yahya was spreading in the same way, from reading group to reading group, from Yahya group to Yahya group, and from one of Wells's readings to another, because for over a year she stopped everything else and toured the country nonstop. But if the lesson of Yahya and John Wesley is that small, close-knit groups have the power to magnify the epidemic potential of a message or idea, that conclusion still leaves a number of critical questions unanswered. The word group, for instance, is a term used to describe everything from a basketball team to the Teamsters Union, from two couples on a holiday to the Republican Party. If we are interested in starting an epidemic, in reaching a tipping point, what are the most effective kinds of groups? Is there any simple rule of thumb that distinguishes a group with real social authority from a group with little power at all? As it turns out, there is. It's called the Rule of 150, and it is a fascinating example of the strange and unexpected ways in which context affects the course of social epidemics.